right, Ms. Clark, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Denise Clark and I represent Emmett Jafari. This matter is before the court on a motion 12B6. And as to be clear with the court, we're asking that the court remand this matter back to Eastern District with instructions also consistent with Kasdan. Mr. Jafari was employed with the Greater Richmond Transit Company, where he provided driving services, including supervising some of the bus drivers there. Mr. Jafari alleges facts in his complaint, which he filed pro se, which he indicates that he had made inquiries concerning his compensation plan. He initially was informed that he would have to file his concerns or his inquiry pursuant to a company internal policy. He did wait and do that, exactly that, after there was a change in the compensation plan with what I will note as GRTC, for Greater Richmond Transit Company. After filing that complaint, essentially alleging that he had not been paid in accordance with, or properly in accordance with, his compensation plan, Mr. Jafari went through a long period of time during which his complaint was not responded to, during which he suffered some adverse action in the context of the way he was treated on the job, and then ultimately was terminated. Mr. Jafari filed a complaint alleging a number of actions, including a violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act retaliation provision, a violation of ERISA's Section 510 interference claim, and defamation. Those three claims are the claims that are before the court. There were others, but only these three are before the court. Now, with regards to the complaint, I want to say that I believe Kasdan is very much on point with regards to this complaint in terms of the fair notice provisions of the decision. Listening to the questions of the panel earlier, yes, the court did struggle with whether there was ambiguity concerning what it means to file a complaint. And I think what the court ultimately did was settle on this issue of what is fair notice. What distinguishes this case from Minor is the fact that the company adopted an internal policy, much like the company Saint-Gobain Plastics did. And it's pursuant to that internal procedure that a complaint was filed, therefore putting the company on fair notice that there was a complaint concerning compensation. And I want to emphasize compensation as it relates to the ERISA claim here also. So Mr. Jafari was looking to know about his wages as well as his...
Kasdan wasn't out, so obviously there was no determination on fair notice in the district court.
That's true. There was no determination below, and I think that's the reason why we would ask that it be remanded so that there could be a determination as to whether or not this procedure would, in fact, constitute fair notice. I think that there is a policy argument to be made that where an employer has itself adopted a procedure for purposes of understanding what the employee's complaints are, that they are, in fact, saying this is the way we intend to have fair notice to ourselves about our employee complaints. And that is what this company did. There are facts alleged in Mr. Jafari's complaint that I think are very notable. Not only that he made the inquiry before he was, quote, invited, and I think that the parties in this matter have both noted that there was an invitation by the company to file the complaint pursuant to the procedure of GRTC, that he was making it very clear to the human resources person on more than one occasion. So this wasn't an isolated situation where he makes a complaint to one person in HR and then leaves it alone. Over a period of time, he was having an ongoing conversation about his compensation. He was being told by the company that there was a change in the compensation. And during this ongoing dialogue with human resources, he's also being told by his supervisors not to go outside the company. And I think that's a notable set of facts that he alleged in his complaint, because it made it clear that the company was aware that he had alternatives. Those alternatives were to file a complaint with a governmental agency regarding his wages, regarding the fact that he wasn't being paid correctly. And he at least alleges in his complaint a level of knowledge that if he did not get a response soon, that was a possibility. He was encouraged by at least one supervisor, as he alleges in his complaint, that he should not go outside. So I think that in terms of the fair notice issue that the Supreme Court raised in Kasten, there are facts that were alleged here in Mr. Jafari's complaint that clearly demonstrate notice. I also want to point out that I think, as the court has asked questions previously about the Memphis Ball decision, I also agree with the Department of Labor that decision does stand on its own. It is addressing the testimony clause. And I think what has happened is that the district courts have taken that case and used it to apply it to the complaint clause. I don't believe that it's necessary to overturn Memphis Ball as a whole in order to reach a decision concerning the case here. I will say...
You mean the unpublished opinions, Witten, for example. Is that what you mean?
Well, Witten, actually, no, Memphis, the Memphis barbecue case, which was a published decision.
No, but I mean, I thought you'd said that, and maybe I just misunderstood what you were saying. I thought you were saying that we had read Ball, we had subsequently read Ball more broadly.
I did not address Witten. I was talking about the district courts had read Ball more broadly.
See. Okay, thank you.
I want to take a moment to address the ERISA Section 510 claim because I think it is important to make clear that Mr. Jafari alleged facts that discussed the interference with his benefits. And he did so in the context of what he was inquiring about, compensation, which is much broader than wages. If he had just made a complaint about his hourly rate or his salary or used the term wages, that would be one thing. But what happened here was the company announced a change in its compensation plan. And compensation is a much broader term.
He filed an informal brief, did he not?
He did file in this before this court, he did.
Right. Yeah. And he listed the Fair Labor Standards Act and the defamation issues in his informal brief.
Yes, he did.
But he didn't list ERISA.
I
don't believe he listed ERISA.
He may not have.
And our local rules indicate that we only review the issues set out in the informal brief. Do they not?
Your Honor, they do. And I'm just checking.
Don't take your... I mean, if you want to check for rebuttal purposes, I don't want... Or proceed, you can check it. But that was my recollection.
That's correct. Those are the local rules, yes.
I just didn't want you to take your time looking for something.
Understood.
To use it for your argument.
We have raised ERISA here, and the appellee has responded. And I do want to just make it clear that the facts that he has alleged concerning how he was treated concerning his complaint overall, because it's addressing compensation, would be sufficient for a 510 action in that those benefits that he was addressing are, in fact, benefits under a defined benefit plan. Defined benefit plan as opposed to a defined contribution plan is a plan where the employer is making the compensation, often that are making the contributions, and often those contributions are tied to the compensation that one is receiving. So if there was reduction or change in any way that was negative concerning Mr. Jafari's compensation, it certainly would have interfered with the benefits he was receiving. And so his inquiry concerning his compensation as a whole and the facts that he alleges in his complaint would also support a 510 action in that the result of his making his inquiry was, in fact, his termination. Finally, with regards to his defamation claim, the appellee has, in this case, alleged that the company is subject to a qualified privilege because the statements that were being made about Mr. Jafari were made in the context of an employment review. However, the facts are the facts that are alleged in the complaint are, and those that the appellee respond with, suggest that there was some conflict concerning whether or not that inquiry was made in the context of a review of Mr. Jafari's work. In fact, Mr. Jafari alleges that his reviews had been without any negative statements to him at all, and had actually, he had gone through an annual review by the time this next inquiry that was made by his supervisors involved specific questions to individuals he was working with about his quality as in the context of his work on the VIEW contracts. And I think that this raises a question, quite frankly, as to whether they were functioning in the qualified position of looking to review his work, or if they were, in fact, at the time looking for a basis on which to terminate Mr. Jafari.
And I thought the district court dismissed the defamation claim on the grounds that he failed to allege publication.
Yes, and we state that there were two points at which there was publication. One, which we actually make a point in the briefs, that at the time that they made statements directly to him, it was in a room where there were others who were had access to or could have overheard the statements that were being made.
And was that in the complaint?
That was actually in the briefs, and I think that there was at least one paragraph in the complaint where that is alleged. But also in the complaint, there are allegations that are made about these additional inquiries after a time period where a review had already been completed. And those one-on-one discussions regarding Mr. Jafari, we believe, are sufficient enough publication because at that point they were not functioning in that qualified status. And therefore, we think that those facts alleged by Mr. Jafari in his complaint were sufficient to sustain a defamation claim.
If we were to agree with you and determine that the FLSA provision was incorrectly interpreted by the district court under Kasten and send it back for a fair notice determination, as I understand it, on the defamation claim, there was one statement which survived the 12B6 motion.
That's correct.
But the district court determined, since it no longer had any federal causes of action, it was going to send that on to the state court.
That's correct.
So what would happen to that one defamation claim if we sent this back?
At that point in time, I believe that the district court could exercise its pendant jurisdiction over that claim.
So that's not something that we would need to address in an opinion?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
And with that, I will take the rest of my time.
So,
thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Randy Sullivan here on behalf of Old Dominion Transit Management Company, doing business as Greater Richmond Transit Company, or GRTC. I'd like to touch first on the FLSA issue that has obviously been the focus of quite a bit of discussion, both in the Minor versus Boswick argument and in this argument. And in this case, as counsel for Mr. Jafari explained, Mr. Jafari has alleged that he submitted letters or written inquiries about his wages. And on that basis, we would submit that the Kasten decision doesn't have any bearing, given that they were looking at oral versus written and expressly did not decide the internal versus external to a government agency decision. And we would also submit, similar to what counsel for Boswick argued, that, and in response to Judge Duncan's question, that Kasten does not have any bearing on this court's prior decisions in Ball or in Witten. And if I may, I wanted to follow up on a couple of questions that came out of the Ball decision, the reference to the Rayner case in the footnote, and counsel for the Department of Labor mentioned also the Calhoun decision. And I just wanted to mention, in the Calhoun decision, that was under the Surface Transportation Assistance Act. And the specific context of that is, under that act, the Department of Labor has final determination authority. So when this court was reviewing in that decision, it was simply exercising an abuse of discretion analysis to see if whether or not an internal complaint was sufficient was an abuse of discretion by the Department of Labor. And so I don't think that's on point with the decision at issue here, as well as in both the Rayner case and in the Calhoun matter, they were both dealing with public safety issues. And as the district courts, Judge Hudson in the Minor case, Judge Spencer in the Jafari case, at present, they analyzed Rayner specifically and said that they were in a posit because this court was looking at public safety issues. There's greater urgency. They didn't want there to have to be a complaint made to an outside agency because of the public safety issues. And we would submit, obviously, the purpose of the FLSA is quite significant, but it's not looking at public safety. It's looking at protection of employees from substandard working conditions. And if we look at the Ball decision, while it's focused on the testimony clause, certainly it takes a broader analysis, and as Mr. Tower said in his argument, and is looking at the language, the fact that there is no opposition clause language, the fact that Congress seems to have narrowed the scope of the language as compared to other statutes like Title VII, and the fact that if you look at all the language in combination, institute, proceeding, testify, there is formality to that. And from that, determined proceeding has to be an administrative or judicial proceeding. And the district courts, well, initially Witten, this court took that and read it as meaning directly on point with this case, that an internal complaint is not sufficient to be protected under Section 215A3. The district courts have followed suit with that, both in Minor and the Jafari matter, as well as a number of other cases that we have cited, and have focused on the plain language of Section 215A3.
The problem, and I think Ball contributed to the confusion in interpreting 215A3, because it makes it unlawful to discharge an employee because the employee has filed any complaint or instituted or caused to be instituted any proceeding or has testified. They are disjunctive, and they're formality trappings with respect to two of the three, but the first one's pretty thin. It just says filed any complaint. And you have that big disjunctive sitting there that divorces it from the next two.
Yeah, and what the district courts have looked at in that regard, and I think what we would submit is, and a lot of this also comes from Justice Scalia's dissent, is that when you, number one, when you read all
one
of that.
One takes one's character from the company it keeps. And there's a Latin phrase for it, but and you may know it, but I never remember it.
I know what you're talking. I don't know the Latin phrase, but I know what you're referring to. But if you look at one of the points that Justice Scalia makes that I don't think has been made and we would submit has significance is this notion. There's a lot of canons of construction that are looked at for purposes of determining the scope of this. And one of the ones that hadn't been mentioned is you look at the same word that's used several times within the statute and give it the same meaning unless there is some reason not to. And as Justice Scalia cites, every time the word complaint appears in the Fair Labor Standards Act, it has a formal official meaning to it, particularly the Secretary of Labor initiating a complaint or a complaint starting or ending a statute of limitations. And so part of what in terms of construing all this language together, complaint has the formality and a common legal meaning that you're bringing an allegation or a charge before a court or an official. And then that's modified by filed, and then you look at all the other language together, proceeding and institute and all those, and yet another canon, if there's a listing of things that share an attribute, you give that same attribute to everything in the listing.
Yeah, that was the one I was referring to.
Yes. And so I think it's fair to say that the starting with the Ball decision and Witten then interpreting it as being perhaps broader than it was And then you all the district court decisions, and frankly, including district court decisions even before Ball, have looked at this plain language and said we don't need to get to the purpose of the statute because there's no ambiguity with that entire phrase as you read it. Now, the question, I think, came up about, well, shouldn't this serve the purpose of the Fair Labor Standards Act? And I think the Ball Court and a number of the other courts have addressed that by saying, look, if these allegations in Ball, for example, are true, it's a moral problem. But we're constrained by what Congress has put in the statute to apply it as it is.
But with respect to very different language in a disjunctive phrase.
But I would, and if Your Honor is getting at, don't we give separate meaning to language? I would echo again, and in large part from practical experience, what Mr. Tower said about, you know, a complaint can be filed before, I just had one recently filed before the State Department of Labor in a different state, and the employer got notice of it. Nothing happened. There was no proceeding, no interviews, no investigation, no nothing, but the employee would have been protected under Section 215A3 because they had filed a complaint, even though there was no proceeding that was ongoing. And the other point I would make on that, because there are criminal provisions under the FLSA, this language of causing to be instituted a proceeding and institute a proceeding, it certainly seems as though if somebody provides information that wouldn't necessarily be considered a complaint, but they provide information either as part of an investigation or something else that prompts a criminal proceeding, that would have one meaning under causing to be instituted, for example, whereas it's not filing a complaint. So we would submit that there's no inconsistency or no superfluousness, if that's the appropriate word, with a plain language construction of Section 215A3, where the filing a complaint has to be filed with a court or with an administrative agency. And certainly the district court here looked at Ball, looked at Witten, distinguished Rayner, and looked at the other district court decisions, and we would submit properly decided that the internal letters that were submitted by Mr. Jafari were not sufficient. Now, I did want to address one other point. Your Honors, I think, had asked about the Second Circuit, and I would just cite to a case called Hyun Mi Son, Hyun Mi Son, that is a district court decision from the Southern District of New York. Judge Shinlin, I just have a Westlaw site, 2011 Westlaw 4716344, and it's dated October 7, 2011. And that case is directly on point and involved a plaintiff who was terminated. She filed a complaint under the FLSA anti-retaliation provision, said she was terminated for complaining, but only complained internally. And Judge Shinlin cited to the Lambert decision from the Second Circuit and referenced it as being abrogated on other grounds, but said still holds true in this circuit that internal complaints are not sufficient. So the response, I guess, to the reference of a case cited earlier in the minor argument is that the abrogation is with respect to oral complaints, not with respect to an internal complaint decision. Just to quickly address the ERISA and defamation arguments, Your Honor, we would agree that the ERISA claim is not properly before this court. And in fact, just as a practical matter, even in the complaint, ERISA Section 510 wasn't referenced. And so what the district court did is basically took the allegations that were before it, which dealt with breach of unilateral contract, failure to give notice, public policy under Virginia, and dismissed those, and then also said if what Mr. Jafari is alleging is ERISA Section 510, the court also found that that failed to state a claim because there's no allegation of any sort of purposeful interference with benefits. So we obviously would submit that that is properly decided. The other Mr. Jafari now seems to be alleging retaliation under ERISA Section 510, and that specific provision contemplates that in order to show retaliation, or it's unlawful for a person to discharge any person because he has given information or has testified or is about to testify in any inquiry or proceeding relating to this chapter. And we would cite the court to prior precedent from the Fourth Circuit called King versus Marriott International Incorporated, which site is 337 F3D 421. And interestingly, that's a 2003 decision. Interestingly, the court there cites to the Ball decision for construction purposes, but then proceeds to find that this language under ERISA Section 510 requires an external complaint to the government because it's talking about an inquiry or a proceeding and does not protect an internal complaint. And we would submit that that's directly on point and would bar an ERISA Section 510 retaliation claim by Mr. Jafari if the court gets to the point of considering it. The other point that I would like to make is we would submit in large part that what Mr. Jafari is now asking the court to do is to speculate as to what was in his allegations, his complaints, and it's clear throughout his complaint that he complained about wages, pay concerns. He even refers to one of his letters as complaint about wage inequities, I believe, or improper wages. It's clear from his complaint he was inquiring and complaining about wages. And what Mr. Jafari now is asking is for the couple of times that compensation is used instead, for there to be an assumption that that might include employee benefit plans, and therefore that somehow led to some intent on the part of GRTC to terminate him. And again, we would submit there's no proper allegation of any sort of intent to interfere with his benefits. And then finally, with respect to the defamation claim, these, as a simple matter, the defamation issues that were alleged, or at least two of the defamation issues that were alleged, came out of the termination meeting when his employment was terminated. He alleged that he was handed an enveloped letter, no allegation that it was opened or anybody else saw it. And he also alleged that when he asked, "Why am I being terminated?" the chief operating officer said, "Your supervisory skills have diminished," which is one of the phrases in the letter. And the letter will tell you all the, you know, the other reasons. And Your Honor, your comment about the letter allegation was dismissed because there was no publication is exactly right. And the district court considered the other phrase about your supervisory skills have diminished as a separate allegation of defamation and having nothing to do with qualified privilege, also dismissed that one as a pure statement of opinion because it's a relative statement depending on the viewpoint of the speaker and is not alleging any sort of factual support for it. And we would submit that's a proper decision. We have cited in our brief to the Raytheon versus Highland case from the Virginia Supreme Court, which dealt with very similar sorts of allegations. For example, found a comment that the employee in a performance evaluation was too verbose and used too much volume in speaking. And the court said that's clearly a statement of opinion. It's not something that's provable as false or true. Somebody else might disagree with it, but it depends on the perspective of the speaker. So we would submit that the defamation claim was also properly dismissed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Clark, you have some time remaining.
My remaining time, I'd like to just simply address the ERISA issue. I think I've made it clear at the outset that Mr. Jafari had been acting pro se. In fact, he acted pro se all the way through the informal briefing before this court. The ERISA claim was, in fact, alleged in the original complaint. It was briefed below, and it was always articulated as an ERISA 510 action, although the section was not specifically used. Instead, what was referenced was the fact that he was terminated in violation of ERISA because of the non-contributory plans and being denied access to those, not as he articulated the phrase, non-contributory plans. I interpret that to mean a defined benefit plan, not a defined contribution plan.
If he prevails on this FLSA claim, would his damages for that success on that claim encompass his ERISA rights and privileges?
It's not clear to me on these facts whether or not it would, because there are what is missing are the specific details about the plan.
That's part of my issue. Did he ever specifically, and the district court wasn't clear about what he was alleging under ERISA. Was it 510 retaliation?
I believe interference. So in other words, and which is distinguishable, interference can go to not providing an individual enough information regarding their benefit plans. It does in order for them to know what their rights and whether or not they know if they're vested, if the time is being counted accurately, et cetera. It doesn't necessarily have to result in termination.
And did you by any chance have a record cite on the informal brief? Or did you have?
I could not find. I don't have a record cite on the informal brief. And that's why I want to say I believe below in the informal briefing, it was not specifically detailed.
On appeal. That was.
Right, on appeal. What I would request if the court were, because Mr. Jafari was acting pro se, is that if this claim is upheld as dismissed, we would ask that it be held as dismissed without prejudice for him to reallege if the court is inclined to let the Fair Labor Standards Act claim go back to the district court.
That's all the time. Thank you. I'll ask the clerk to adjourn court, and then we'll come down and...